The views expressed in the following program are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of the Key Biscayne Independent or Miami Fourth Estate. Portions were pre-recorded.
And again, I think of her. I think of you. And I want to love you. She will always be my friend.
Live from Key Biscayne, Florida, this is Antisocial, the program that looks at the headlines in the news, our social media feeds, what people are talking about, and really just tries to keep it straight. I'm Tony Winton.
This is John Pacenti.
Well, John, it's been just a whirlwind. I think that was your word. No, you used the word vortex.
There must be a vortex over Key Biscayne. I mean, you would think this is New York City in the last month and a half, two months.
Right. Starting at, and we've alluded to this on a previous show, starting at the end of the year and then continuing on, and added to two major sex crime investigations cases, one state, one federal. We had the death of a beloved resident that involved a collision with an e-bike. We have major changes to state legislation happening about condos, which people in this community care a lot about. And then, of course, we have been reporting big changes with the resiliency plan, you know, this $300 million plan to possibly to secure the village from sea level rise. And that is coming up for all big discussions in the next coming weeks. So it has been a news vortex. But we have someone to help steer us a little bit today.
Yes, we do. David S. Weinstein, lawyer extraordinaire, 2 decades of experience as a federal and state prosecutor. More than a decade in private practice. Welcome, David.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Tony. Appreciate you guys having me on. Look, I'm glad to help guide you through the vortex and what seems like a storm that keeps landing on the key and not the type that we experience during rainy season, hurricane season, or otherwise. It seems that there's a lot of things going on in the key these days.
Right. And they do involve, you know, with all of your experience starting on the prosecution side, now you're in private practice. Just if you could, maybe you've handled a lot of these cases. One case involves allegations that is more than a decade old. Another one involves the federal system surveillance by the FBI. That was the first one. Let's start with that. How does that work? And in the Department of Justice, where you used to work and now is private practice, help us a little bit understanding, you know, what are some of the difficulties and how the government and the defense, obviously they represent clients, how that interacts?
Well, Tony, you know, with regard to that first case, that's a federal case where the allegations are not only possession, downloading, dissemination of child pornography, but interaction with individuals who are minors. There is a nationwide center for abused children that's staffed by both the FBI and Secret Service, and it's their job to go out on the web and look for these things. And while they're looking for them, the people who have this material don't know it's the feds who are looking for them. And so they use that to start up their investigations, and it's all legitimately done. They have authorization to do this. They have permission to have access. They follow the laws, the rules, and regulations. This is not Big Brother who's looking out on you. It is law enforcement seeking to make sure that children who are abused are not repeatedly abused. Unfortunately, in the case involving the possession and dissemination of child pornography, some of the videos that are out there, Tony and John, are decades old. And, you know, unfortunately, what happens is that these children continue to get abused and abused again as these videos get put out there. And so they collect the information, they look at IP addresses, and then they go to the courts and they get search warrants, they get surveillance warrants, and they go out, collect the information. Oftentimes, they pose as potential individuals, which is not what happened in this situation. But once they collect all this information with court permission, they begin to build their case. And the case involves this material that's been downloaded, that's been disseminated, that's been produced. They'll execute a search warrant. They will then seize computers and cell phones. They'll be given authorization to look through those, and they'll begin to build their case. And that's what happened in the first case.
But I want to get back to something, because one of the things that's happening in our community is there's this anxiousness. Parents, understandably, very concerned about this activity. But what you're suggesting that this isn't necessarily this often originates because there's a national program to find this material. It's not like it's I don't want to use the word homegrown, but it's not like that there's a something that originates there. It's more in response to a search. Well, we don't know much about the second case because the government recently amended their indictment, added more and serious charges. We know that the first case involved a victim in Texas.
Right. And Tony, often it's a combination of both of those. I mean, look, parents should be monitoring their children's activity, whether it's on a computer, a laptop, a tablet, or a cell phone. Quite frankly, when our child was growing up, she lived in a benevolent dictatorship. Once you cross the threshold, there's no Fourth Amendment in the house. And so, we made sure that we kept an eye on things. And it is often a combination of parents who discover what's going on, or a child who finally says something and the parent realizes that and they reach out to law enforcement. It could be somebody else in the neighborhood who catches wind of what's going on. It could be an internet service provider who's seeing a high volume of activity on a restricted website. And it could be an independent investigation by the protection division of the Secret Service and the FBI, who's going out and gathering information. And so that's how these cases evolve. And then they work themselves down the path, collecting evidence and information, and they continue to develop. And once these cases are filed and developed, they may discover something during their search and seizure that allows them to expand the case.
Well, the issue here on Key Biscayne was that some parents and some political players as well were questioning why didn't the Key Biscayne police alert the community that that William McCann Jr. had been arrested in July, 6 months later till it actually became public. But the fact is, these investigators, the FBI, are trying to crack a ring. I mean, McCann could just be one spoke, is correct?
Correct. And look, the people who download, people who upload, the people who produce this material, they have an extensive network, and many people just go on and they download it or upload it and whatever it might be. And yeah, part of what happens when these people are arrested, they're offered an opportunity to tell law enforcement how they obtained it, where they got it, what else was involved. They may take law enforcement up on that opportunity. They may not. As you are well aware, federal courts are not as open as state courts are. But getting back to your question about the concern that local parents had on the Key about why the Key Biscayne police didn't report it, I don't know whether or not they were even involved in the initial arrest. It's not a local law enforcement arrest. It was the Bureau.
I think they were involved in traffic, protecting streets and whatnot as the FBI, apprehended him.
But they're aiding and assisting the agency. They're going to take the direction from them. The last thing the federal agency wants is for local law enforcement to tip off somebody and something they're potentially working on, valuable information, gets quickly deleted, put away, there's an obstruction in their investigation. So while I sympathize certainly with parents and anybody else who lives on the Key who wants to know what's going on, oftentimes we have to defer to law enforcement as long as they're operating within the proper sphere. And, now mm-hmm. being out in private practice, I'm not suggesting that every time law enforcement does something, they do it the right way. Oftentimes they don't do it the right way. And so that's why I'm here on the defense side to make sure that they're following practices and procedures.
Well, one point I want to make is that, as people were clamoring and, scoring political points off the Key Biscayne police because, they didn't alert the community to this federal arrest, that if you are concerned about children, then you will understand that if the FBI is trying to get more predators and that their investigation would be put at risk if they publicized it.
Right. And in fact, that is what the government said in its pleadings, that it was doing that. So yes, it was a public record in the sense that it was a, there was an arrest, there was an indictment, and the Key Biscayne police, you know, might have been involved in some security way to make sure that the federal officers were able to do their jobs without running afoul of, you know, some other problem. But, you know, if the goal is to expand the investigation, then, and I should, we should point out that the defendant in this case was and remains in custody from the very beginning. He didn't even seek a bond. So he remains in pretrial detention.
I mean, you know, look, Tony and John, part of that is because he certainly would be a risk to the community. And then given the amount of time he's looking at, some of which are mandatory minimum sentences, he's going to be incarcerated if he is in fact convicted. I'm not suggesting that the government's proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt. That's something that the government has to do. But, you know, based on the information that's contained in public documents that are filed with the clerk of court, serious allegations, looks like they have the support for it. And he wasn't going to win at a pretrial detention hearing. The court, in all likelihood, would have detained him anyways. And so at this point, you know, there's a slight benefit to a stipulation for detention versus a court finding that he is, in fact, a danger to the community and a risk of flight.
But because of electronic records, these cases are pretty well zipped up, right? I mean, they have, you know, talking on text. They have his computer traffic. They have the images coming in. They have him soliciting more images to an undercover officer. And then, you know, there a plea deal was not a plea deal, but a plea.
It was we know there was a negotiation.
Right.
There's always a negotiation. Yeah. And then, 85 to 90% of federal cases are resolved through negotiations and not through trial.
And then all of a sudden they hit him with four more charges, more serious charges with, you know, longer mandatory minimums. And
a potential life term.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, and that's the result of negotiations. You know, look, there were two charges on the table to begin with. They were negotiating what the resolution might be, and that would have included not filing additional charges. I've seen that on both sides of my practice. And if you turn down the plea, you know, it's not like it's just a card game. You know, if they said, this is what it is, and we're not going to file anything else, and the time comes and goes for you to accept the deal that's on the table and you turn it down, well, then they're going to follow up. They're going to go ahead and
let's pivot to the other case here. And there's news on that today. That's one that's maybe in some ways more, it's been certainly going on longer. And that is the case of Oscar Olea, where some of the offenses that are now have been formally made by the local prosecutors, the state attorney's office involving this gymnastics coach go back 14 even longer years, two women coming, they're now adults, coming forward, speaking to police, and these charges also very, very serious, which cover possibly a life sentence.
Yes. I mean, we were talking before the show that I thought that this was unique, that, you know, this case goes back 10, 12 years. But David, you say that isn't that unique, that these...
No, unfortunately, John and Tony, it's not unique. I mean, look at the case involving the U.S. women's Olympic team and their coach, what was going on, you know, University of Michigan. There was also the wrestling coach that had abused some of the kids he was coaching, Sandusky at Penn State. You know, we don't need to go through the litany of all of them, but it's tragically unfortunate that these types of cases often sit in the background. Nobody says anything. Look, you're dealing with minors who are going to get dragged through the court process here. And it is an excruciating process, especially for a child. And then you have parents who are concerned about what's going to happen to their child. Children are very reluctant to come forward to begin with. There's a whole grooming aspect that goes in. And, you know, they become prey to these defendants as to what's going on. And so, unfortunately, it takes time. I don't want to get into, and again, all allegations, the Catholic Church, the Boy Scouts, we unfortunately see this happen on a variety of different levels. And it's not until they become adults and they decide that, you know what, I've had enough, and I can't harbor the secret anymore. That's why we've seen legislation changing statute of limitations.
And again, we should point out first that these two cases, the Key Biscayne Police Chief Frank Souza has said they are not related. And number two, they're just happening, you know, overlapping in a time period. And then the second, in terms of the prosecutions anyway. And then secondly, that of course, both of these defendants are innocent until proven guilty. These are allegations. In the case of Mr. Olea, he was he surrendered to authorities today. A judge denied bond. There'll be another bond hearing tomorrow. But his attorney making the point that he has been cooperating as much as possible with the authorities and in fact surrendered when he was notified that there was a warrant out for him.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get back to the statute of limitations. Tell me how those have changed.
Well, you know, not only in Florida, but, you know, throughout the country. Look, if you're a minor and you are abused by somebody, you know, as long as it was a life felony, then the criminal prosecution can be instituted at any point in time. Once you're over the age of 16, there becomes a different level of felony. And so the prosecution can't be initiated at any point in time. And so legislatures have been asked to change the statute of limitation with regard to when the reporting took place, when the statute runs, and things of that nature, because they recognize and realize that while there's a due process element involved, that every defendant is entitled to have the case brought forward in a timely fashion so that they're not deprived of a due process right, meaning their ability to defend themselves, to call witnesses, to collect and gather and present evidence, that the nature of these crimes in and of themselves require that prosecution be allowed to be instituted at any point in time for certain cases that involves minor children. And those are children under the age of 16, children under the age of 13. And so that's why the legislature has had to step in and make sure that these cases can go forward.
Let me, you know, you're in kind of a position where you can wear both hats, right? As a prosecutor and as a defense attorney. In this case, you're talking about older allegations. You have fading memories. Mm-hmm. There may be very little or no forensics.
Right.
Challenges for a prosecutor, or I guess from a defense point of view, these are things to you'll be very focused in.
It's a very steep hill that they're climbing up against. You know, remember in a case involving a sexual assault that occurs and then is reported immediately, you have forensic evidence that's collected. There are officers that are called in, they collect evidence, and you have physical proof of what took place. In all other cases where it's not either immediately reported or there's a long delay in reporting, it's a he said, she said, or a he said, or a she said, she said. And we've seen examples of this throughout the country. You saw it in the Bill Cosby case. You saw it in other cases where there have been allegations of sexual batteries that have taken place, and it becomes the word of a victim against the word of a defendant who says, no, that didn't happen. And then with the loss of time and with memory, and when you're dealing with minors whose memories are different now than they were when they were children, it becomes a difficult obstacle for the prosecution to overcome. And it becomes something where a jury has to hear the testimony, and then they have to decide who's telling the truth here.
Yes, we are talking to David S. Weinstein, and we're going to take a little break here. We're going to come back and continue our conversation. This is John Vicente.
I'm Tony Winton, and we are back on Antisocial. And our guest is David S. Weinstein, a veteran criminal defense lawyer working for both the state and federal government as a prosecutor, now in private practice. And we had a tough discussion there about these difficult sex crime cases that are now really front of mind in Key Biscayne. But we also know that you've worked in other fields that involve, I guess, more national topics, and we have some big ones going on right now with the President of the United States.
Yes, the U.S. Supreme Court has decided to take up Donald Trump's appeal on whether he has, what is it, immunity?
Well, it's an immunity.
On immunity, whether he could be held liable for the January 6th insurrection. And it's kind of caused a shock among the national pundits, that's for sure.
Right. I mean, that's and I get your reaction. This is an unprecedented case, and the Supreme Court now weighing in on almost, it seems like, every step.
Well, you know, Tony and John, I'm not surprised that it's gotten to them this quickly, certainly because we're in the midst of an election year, and the defendant is appearing to be on his way to running for office yet again in a national one in an election that's going to be taking place in November. And while in more traditional cases, they would let this wind its way through the district court, the Court of Appeals, and then on its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, they've been asked to step in now on two separate cases. We're still waiting to see what they have to say in the other one. But on the case regarding the immunity issue that was raised first in the district court in the District of Columbia, where an adverse ruling came in against the former president, and then it went up to the Court of Appeals. The special prosecutor tried to leapfrog over that and just take it to the U.S. Supreme Court so that it would move along quicker. He was not successful then. So the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit issued a rather lengthy opinion, and one that explained why his claims of immunity didn't apply. And so the defense did what was expected by them. And certainly their first line of defense has always been to delay things, hoping that they can delay it past the election, that he can somehow be elected and then absolve himself. That remains to be seen. But for the moment, now they've stepped in. And in a single page order that was all of two paragraphs long, they have teed up in one sentence this issue of presidential immunity. And it's important. Look, I'm a lawyer, so my job is to look at words and see what the words say and then try and interpret what they mean. And that's what a variety of pundits across the nation have been doing in the last 12 hours or so since we saw anything about this ruling. And so, you know, the easiest way to boil this down is to look at the one sentence that they are considering. And they have teed up the following question, and I'm reading from the grant of cert that was issued late yesterday afternoon. And the question is whether, and if so, to what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office? And my emphasis is intentional, because they picked these words for a reason, and it is a very narrow issue that they're addressing. They've set an expedited schedule for this matter to be heard. It's been teed up back to be in front of them for oral argument on the 22nd of April. The petitioner's briefs are due coming up in March. The reply from the government, response from the defense are due shortly after that. And any amicus who want to file, you know, start writing and get in there now. And so, you know, the question is, you know, you have to be a former president, according to their question here. And then what is it you're going to be arguing about? Presidential immunity from criminal prosecution. And then when did the conduct occur? It is alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office.
Well, let me parse that very carefully. Alleged by whom? My understanding of what the government, Jack Smith, has been saying is that None of the things that are being alleged were official acts.
Exactly.
Interfering with an election is in no way an official duty of the president.
Right. So
isn't it kind of like a false question? I mean, I guess my initial thing.
Yeah. I mean, even if they rule for Trump, I don't know if that precludes Smith from moving on.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm kind of wondering. Yeah.
Well, look, the use of the word alleged in their sentence, you know, is for conduct alleged to involve official acts. So their use of the word alleged is what the defendant is alleging. He is alleging that it involved official acts. If they find out it didn't involve an official acts, they will have ruled on that. And so it's the allegations of the former president, not of the federal government. And remember, this has nothing to do right now. It will have implications with this, the classified documents cases pending down here in Fort Pierce, but this deals with his claim that in the D.C. case, he was engaged in acts that he alleges were official acts during his tenure in office. And that's something that was argued in the district court, something that was argued in the Court of Appeals, and they shot both of those, all of those arguments down. So that's the alleged acts that they're talking about here.
Knowing trial schedules and scheduling, and as you do, is there any, like, what is your thinking that this would actually get tried in front of a jury before the election?
There's a very good chance. You know, it all depends how quickly they render an opinion. Look, they're capable of rendering opinions very quickly. Everybody looks back towards Nixon, Bush versus Gore. In the case with Nixon, they rendered an opinion 16 days after they heard the rest of the arguments. And so, you know, look, if this goes on track and they hear oral argument in, you know, late April, they could render an opinion within a couple of weeks of that. That puts you in May. That goes back to the judge. The judge says, okay, fine. Here's how much time you need. You know, we expected it to come back. I hope you all weren't sitting on your behinds while you were waiting for it to go away, because it didn't go away. I already told you what needs to go on. I know what needs to take place. This is not a state case in Florida, so there's no depositions that are going to be occurring here. And so you've got the evidence. You better be ready. And here is the trial schedule. And look, it's not going to go to trial in May, but it certainly could go to trial in August on the D.C. Circuit case. Now, keep in mind, he's got a case up in New York State that's set to go to trial March 25th, I believe, is the trial date on that one. So that one's going to get teed up, ready to go. This is going to have an impact, I would expect, on the Mar-a-Lago case that has a hearing on Friday. They're going to address some of that in terms of scheduling with that. But they could tee this D.C. Circuit case back up if the opinion comes back in favor of the special prosecutor against the defendant for some time, you know, in August. And I understand that's when the conventions are going to take place and he's going to want to be there. Well, you know what?
We have another vortex forming.
Yeah.
Here's move to a different city. This is what
all of this reminds me of. We're talking about the minutia. We're talking about the ins and outs of the legality of it all. But we, the American citizen, is like the frog in the boiling pot of water. We're not realizing that slowly but surely the heat's being turned up and our democracy is at risk. The legitimacy of the Supreme Court will be decided on this issue. For months, you know, journalists have detailed how the conservative justices, Alito, Thomas, have been basically getting gifts, expensive gifts, curried by wealthy billionaires. And, you know, we're going to see if they're going to be able to either be partisan hacks or actual legal scholars here. And if they come off to the world that as partisan hacks, then whatever legitimacy the U.S. Supreme Court had is out the window.
And look, you know, John, I can't predict what will happen here, but just because you're a conservative judge doesn't necessarily mean you always rule in favor of the government, or that, you know, you're going to rule in favor of the defendant this time because he supports your conservative viewpoints and he's the one who puts you on the bench. Look, we're all aware of who put these judges on the bench and how they got there and why it was done and what the hopes were of the people who put them there. But, you know, and call me naive if you want. I've been part of the criminal justice system and the legal system here for, you know, coming up on four decades. And you have to believe that these judges can put it all aside. I know that many people didn't think that's what happened in Bush versus Gore and that they came down the way they came down because of the way that they're slanted. I think the optics look terrible with regard to what you were just talking about, both based on things that have been provided to these justices, based on their relationships with their significant others and where they align and things of that nature. But the one thing that's absolutely true is that we're in the pot of water and they keep turning up the heat, and it's going to be boiling soon. And I have to hope that they will look at the law, they will consider what's going on here, and they will not continue to enable somebody who thinks that he is above the law, and they will hold him accountable for what took place.
All right. David Weinstein, I want to thank you for being our guest. We're out of time, but hopefully we'll be able to bring you back as all of these things meander on and the vortex builds.
As long as we don't get sucked into the vortex, Tony, yes, you know where to find me. And John,
thank you.
I'm available.
All right. Thank you very much, David Weinstein.
Thank you.
I think you said it best, John, criminal attorney, criminal defense attorney par excellence, our guest on Antisocial. We'll be back right after this. Keep it scared, Island Paradise. Keep it scared.
And we go down the trails to the north point of the Bearcut Bridge.
This is John Pacenti.
I'm Tony Winton, and you're back on Antisocial. And John, what a great segment that was for someone with that much experience to kind of fill us in on how this is going to play out. And you and I, you both covered these cases, but from that perspective, you know, this is going to be some very intense lawyering about how these very difficult cases that are so concerning to the community are going to play out in court.
Yeah. I could have talked to him for another half hour, 45 minutes.
And it's just, there's so many issues, and we will be following those in the Key Biscayne Independent as we go on. But we have, as we said at the beginning of the show, a lot of other things going on.
A lot of other things. Now, you talked to Representative Vicky Lopez on what's going on in Tallahassee during the session on some issues that...
Which is underway right this second.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of things happening that the legislature is moving towards conclusion on that are of big interest to Key Biscayne. And I, you know, will love. She's a friend of the program, been on many times, and I know she'll come back on when she gets to breathe. but we'll focus on two of them here. One of them is the change in state law on e-bikes and scooters.
That's right.
Right. So one of the things in the background here, and there's a lot of debate going on in the community about whether this temporary ban should be extended permanently. If it is extended permanently, what form should it take? Should it be the same as it is now? Should there be openings allowed for certain kinds of uses by certain age groups and locations, right? Right now, it only applies to village streets. It doesn't apply to Crandon Boulevard. Right. So a lot of different legalities going on. This bill would allow localities to put in age restrictions like Key Biscayne on these devices. She tried to do this a year ago, and it was alive for 15 days. And then she was told, and we reported this at the time, the House leadership said, this isn't going anywhere. And the Village of Key Biscayne can, your representative, your city that you're trying to speak for, they can regulate. They have enough power to do it as they want. We don't need to change the state law. So it kind of died. Now, in the wake of this horrible tragedy that befell a beloved tutor, this idea in a more condensed form is moving quickly. It has already gone past a couple of major votes. We're expecting, I think, third reading vote later today. We're talking on a Thursday. And then the posture is that her belief is it's an amendment to a pending transportation bill. That's why they were able to do it so fast. They tacked it on to something. And the thinking is that the Senate will just agree to the House version, and this could be law very soon.
Yes, and of course, now the question is, does Key Biscayne even want it? You know, do they want to have police officers trying to discern, is that a 16-year-old or a 15-year-old? Is that a Class 1 bike, or is that a Class 3 bike? I don't know. It seems almost impossible to enforce.
Right, and that is the other question. How do you have the balancing interest here? And it is not an easy question. There's no firm number on, and it's not the same problem in every locality, right? So that's
it's all different.
Yeah, it's different everywhere. So
I mean, Bal Harbour is, you know, taking what happened here on Key Biscayne and looking to ban bikes on a road that fronts the beach, in which, you know, seniors, but they have a very small population, senior population, very different than Key Biscayne,
and so you've got several different layers of questions, right? So the village is right now here. These devices are lawful on...
Well, on Crandon
Boulevard. Right. But There's also been a change with respect to sidewalks.
That's
right. Because nowhere in the state are motorized devices allowed on sidewalks. An e-bike that is being operated manually, if you're pedaling, is treated as a bicycle. So again, this is this law enforcement problem, right? Is the cop supposed to look at a person and say, oh, are they pedaling or are they fake pedaling or is there in full motor or whatever it is? I mean, it creates a lot of these difficult things. But right now, scooters, e-scooters, not allowed on sidewalks. And we have a case where an individual was issued a citation right. and it led to alleged bad interaction with a law enforcement officer. And that is now pending as a misdemeanor. But the question is the village going to start enforcing on sidewalks? It appears that they are.
So there's two questions that come up with this arrest. One, do you really want e-bikes on the roads like a car? They only go like 30 miles per hour. I don't know if that's safe. And B, also in the state law, it says that these are bicycles and they're supposed to be treated like bicycles. So do we have the state law kind of butting up against each other here? You know, and the fact is that the village didn't. I mean, I don't know how many people have seen little kids riding motorized scooters all over the place and they never enforced it. And then this guy coming to work, becomes the poster child on a bad Friday or whenever they.
Right. It's just, there are interests here, right? We have bicycle lanes that exist. There's a national program and Key Biscayne is behind it along with many other supported it along with many other municipalities to encourage cycling, to encourage other forms of mobility to try and ease traffic, mm-hmm. right? Pedal power. That has been a practice. People in Key Biscayne don't like the Pelotons, which sometimes clog up mm-hmm. the roadway leading out of the key. But in general, people are supportive of cycling. So how do you thread this needle? It's not easy, especially since there are, as you pointed out, different classes of e-bikes. Not all of them are these things that do 30 miles an hour. There are lesser classes that are really just meant to assist someone yeah. pedaling and to get around. What's wrong with that if they're morally basically a cyclist? Today, right? That's a good question.
Today I was coming into the key. And there was pedal bicyclists, and then there was an adult on a motorized scooter, and they were all kind of going the same. They were all moving in the same direction at the same kind of the same speed, And I thought, well, that looks pretty safe. Now I've also been walking on the Rickenbacker and almost like thrown overboard by an e-bike, with a kid on an e-bike, So I mean. Everybody has a different viewpoint. Like my viewpoint is like, yeah, let them be in the bike lanes, but keep them off the sidewalks. And then somebody else might have a different kind of view.
Right.
So, and then when you have like this kid that was just coming from the road into getting a drink at the gas station and, he's moving from the road into a commercial area.
Right. And so that is something, that is another aspect of this. So what is the timetable, right? So exit this one on the timetable. The timetable is that this temporary ban is in effect. It'll expire sometime in April. The idea is it would probably be extended for another period of time while they get to their final idea of what that looks like. And the understanding of whether or not, and we expect this bill will pass, whether or not Key Biscayne can even make these different changes. And then simultaneously, and we haven't been able to update this, we know that there is a parallel effort happening in the Board of County Commissioners at the county level to basically grant Key Biscayne the power to also regulate Crandon Boulevard. That requires action by the county government. But it is moving along. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds. So that's where everything is. We're looking at a time frame sometime in May, probably. Well, this will come to a head. And we're going to keep reporting on it, getting different community voices. People should reach out to us because, in a public debate, people are going to have different issues and different points of view, and we want to report those points of view fairly. Moving on.
Yes, what else can we talk about?
Moving on. Well, we have Condo 3.0.
Oh, that's right.
Condo 3.0, which I would say is probably her, Vicky Lopez's, signature legislation that she talked. We talked about. There was a town hall meeting here in Key Biscayne. She's had them all over her district. You went to one of them involving the state attorney's office. We've talked to Catherine Fernandez Rundle, the current, about her prosecutions of mismanagement at other homeowners associations. It is a not just a Key Biscayne issue. This is a statewide issue.
Do you remember what the state attorney said? She said, if you want to commit a crime, one of the best places to do is to get on one of these boards.
Well, you know, she's very passionate about it. And she was, this is a group now where this set of changes looks like it's moving along very soon in both the House and the Senate. So we're also monitoring that. There are some technical things going on back and forth in terms of amendments. We will update the story soon. So this is one of the things to watch, but it looks like it's going to happen.
Yeah. And you know, the big, a big component of this is transparency. And that is just for the corrupt boards, that this is how they've been operating. You know, when they've been getting perks and they've been cutting deals with vendors, they've been able to keep all that under the radar, in the clock, you know, sweep it under the rug. And this new Condo 3.0 is designed to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Yeah. Well, the other big aspect of that, of course, is for owners and residents of units to be able to get information from the buildings where they live. That has also been a big, I mean, how many times have we talked to, in doing stories, talking to owners and residents, say, I can't get any information. They won't give me any information, that sort of thing. Or fearing that they would be retaliated against. This.
Oh, yeah, that's a huge problem.
This legislation is put some real teeth in a number of facets. So we'll be following that as well. But I just want, on the legislative side, these are other big stories that are happening. And then the last thing, just before we exit this little bit here, is we do have a major meeting coming up soon about the Big Dig.
Yeah.
We need a sounder for Big Dig. What could it be?
It could just be construction equipment. Like,
we could do that, maybe. All right, how about Bob the Builder? You know that kid song? Yeah.
Who is our Bob the Builder? Is it our village manager?
I don't know. Yeah, Steve the Builder. I don't know. That's also coming up. And, you know, there's one more aspect, critical aspect of the, again, the debate that the council keeps having about just how fast the streets need to be drained when we have a lot of rain. And that is not a settled question.
Yeah, it's pay now or pay later or pay more later.
Or just have lots of flooding.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the staff.
Live with it.
You want to spend, you know, at least $250 million to have a system that is easily upgradable, that you won't have to, like, you know, because of sea level rise in 20 years, go, oh, my God, we've miscalculated. We need to dig up the roads again.
Right. Well, so. And you know, try to, as we move to that coverage, we'll try to keep it on the science and what is expected and what isn't expected. And people can certainly express concerns about the costs, but it should be, whether you're for it or against it, really, it should be based on some kind of understanding, right, of what the risks are. So we'll try to make sure that's part of the coverage. All right, well, we'll close out our show in just a moment. It's been really action-packed. We'll be back right after this. I'm Tony Winton. You're on listening to Antisocial.
This is John Pisani.
Well, we just wanted to wrap up our show by, again, thanking our listeners for following us through some really tough stories here. And we get a lot of comments. Some of them love the show. Some people hate the show. We just try to keep getting them out there and getting these issues for discussion. And we actually do encourage all kinds of comments. So really, please keep them coming. We're not offended, even if you might be. but no, I mean, it's important for us to hear back from you, and we encourage that. You can always write to us at info@kbindependent.org, info@kbindependent.org. And that's also the same place, kbindependent.org, where you can make a donation to this podcast and to the work that we're doing. We're a nonprofit news organization hoping to expand to other parts of Miami-Dade County. And we're expected to do that this year, and we are grateful for your support.
Yes, we are, because, you know, we don't work for free. This is a time-intensive occupation, and, I mean, there's a lot of news to cover out there, Tony.
Right, and we're heading into, just to remind everyone, we're heading into not just the, we touched on it with the with our guest, David Weinstein, with the national election. We're touching into a very big election here in Key Biscayne. It's we have two open council seats, possibly a third. We haven't heard from Councilmember Kaplan whether he's going to run for re-election. And we have Mayor Joe Rasko has said he is going to run for re-election. But there's all of these offices will be decided this coming summer and fall.
It's going to be crazy.
All right. So thank you for listening. I'm Tony Winton.
John Pisani. Smooth sailing, everybody.
The Bear Cut.